Rafe took a seat and glassed the surrounding terrain, looking for any sign of what might have spooked the deer. After nearly 30 minutes of searching, he picked up his bow and began to follow the trail. Even a good tracker would have lost him in the rocks, but Rafe's skill had long since progressed beyond simply good. He went to his hands and knees and was able to make out the disturbed lichen on the rocks. Once over the knife edge of the ridgeline, the animal's path took it through the thick summer grasses, where his trail was more visible to the trained eye. It was difficult to tell how long the tracks had been there, but he estimated that they were at least a few hours old. The stems of grass were beginning to return to their natural position after being folded downward by the buck's passing. Rafe stood back up. He was on the stalk. Chapter 37. Central Intelligence Agency, Langley, Virginia. Vic Rodriguez dialed Reese's number for the fifth time, and as usual, it went straight to voicemail. He'd received an emergency call that morning from Craig Flynn, a retired CIA officer who had previously served as the Moscow station chief. Flynn had been contacted by a senior official in the Russian SVR named Alexander Zharkov, whom he had known from his Moscow posting but had not heard from in years. Director Zharkov claimed to have come across information on a Russian mafia operation underway in Montana to kill James Reese and Rafe Hastings. Due to the time-sensitive nature of the intelligence, he said there was not time to go through official channels. Because of Flynn's history with Director Zharkov, he assessed the information to be credible. Flynn had worked with Reese's father in an operation to extract a doctor from Czechoslovakia during the Cold War, so he instantly recognized the name James Reese. Though now retired, Flynn still had close connections at Langley, including the director of the Special Activities Division. Changing tactics, Vic hit the intercom button on his phone.
Valerie, connect me to the Flathead County Sheriff's Department in Montana.
Reese showered and made the necessary preparations to keep his promise to take Katie into town. The plan was to have a late breakfast, walk around a bit, and decide whether to stay in town for lunch or get something for the road and head over to Glacier National Park. Clouds had moved in overnight. Fall seemed to be kicking at the door. They each carried a mug of Black Rifle's finest coffee as they left the cabin and climbed into Reese's Land Cruiser. Katie was even trying hers, spruced up the way Reese took his, with local honey and a bit of cream. She found it endlessly amusing that the tough commando liked his coffee a bit on the sweet side. Making the turn onto the paved highway, Reese thought back to his conversation with Thorne a couple of weeks ago and with Rafe the previous evening. It just might be time to start a new chapter, one that did not involve U.S. intelligence covert action programs. It might be time to start a new life with Katie. For Dimitri and his team, watching Rafe Hastings move into and out of his daily glassing spot had become routine. At any point, they could have initiated the ambush, but until word came from Vitya, all they could do was observe. Today was different. He'd arrived far earlier than normal. The men watched as he readied his gear by the light of his headlamp before leaving the vehicle. Then, instead of looking through his scope for a few minutes and returning to his truck, Hastings packed his gear and moved into the valley that he'd so painstakingly observed under the team's watchful eye. Dimitri also noticed that he carried a different weapon today, an ancient-looking bow with a small quiver of arrows. One man with a bow against six with rifles. He had watched his share of American Western films on television to know how those odds had worked out for the Indians. Dimitri stared at the sat phone, willing it to ring. He didn't know where the target was going, but sooner or later he would return to his Land Rover. When he did, they would be waiting. The sun rose, and the valley was soon bathed in an orange glow. He thought of the gray walls of his prison cell back home, the screaming, the blood. The phone vibrated. He answered it and listened as Vitya informed him that they would be initiating their ambush in just a few minutes. He'd grown to like the man and was appreciative of the heads up. There was a decision to make. Should he wait here for Hastings to return? What if the attack raised the alarm and the American military or police came with their helicopters? No. He needed to move in on the target and take him out. It was time. Dmitri slipped the phone into his pack and pulled it on over his shoulders as he stood. His men didn't need to be told to do the same, and soon they were all patrolling past Hastings's vehicle, six abreast. Hastings had a head start of several hours, but was surely trekking slowly as he stalked whatever prey he was after. Dmitri only hunted men. It felt good to be moving after so much waiting. His legs felt strong as he climbed the ridge, the rifle light in his hands. Dmitri watched his men with pride. Dressed in surplus American camouflage uniforms and moving with speed and discipline, they could almost pass for soldiers. He called a halt as they approached the first ridge, and he crept carefully forward to reconnoiter the next valley. He could see the marks where the legs of Hastings's tripod had dug into the soil, and he raised his binoculars to scan the space below him. Satisfied that the target had gone ahead, he waved his men forward. Vitya saw the vehicle move on the screen and quickly dialed Tanya using the burner cell phone that he'd brought along for the occasion. The signal was good on the high ground, and she answered after three rings. They spoke in English.
"Hello? Is Dan there? I'm sorry, you have the wrong number. My apologies."
He pressed the end button, terminating the call. He whistled, getting his men's attention quickly. Their chronic boredom quickly became excitement as they moved down into their prepared ambush positions near the road. Vitya and the rest of his four-man assault team were situated on the long side of the L, with the two-man support by fire element carefully crossing the road to a position perpendicular to the target vehicle's route. When he slowed the SUV to make the turn, Vitya would initiate the ambush with the IED. The vehicle would take fully automatic fire from the front and side, with 180 rounds in the first volley alone. No one in an unarmored vehicle would survive it. Vitya watched the iPad impatiently as the target drove along the ranch roads. Just as it turned onto the highway, Tanya pulled up in her blue 2003 Jetta. She parked the vehicle on the road's narrow shoulder and, as she'd been instructed, popped the hood. She stood helplessly in front of the vehicle wearing yoga pants and a tight tank top, hands placed on her hips. Assuming that chivalry was not yet dead in this northwestern part of the country, they were counting on their targets stopping to assist the attractive motorist in apparent distress. Vitya watched the red dot accelerate on the asphalt highway and knew from experience that it would be in the kill zone in less than 5 minutes. He moved the selector switch on his AKM to the Cyrillic marking for full auto and set it down on the bed of pine straw beside him. Pulling the M57 firing device from his pocket, he connected it to the trailing end of the wire that led to the Claymore Mine's blasting cap. Only the small wire safety bale stood between the device's handle and a catastrophic explosion. He looked at each of the men on the assault team and received nervous but ready nods from them. He couldn't see the camouflaged figures of his second element, but was confident that they were in place. Everyone knew their jobs. Vitya looked at his watch. He needed to give Dmitri a heads up that the ambush was about to be initiated. Even in the unlikely event that their communications were being monitored, there wouldn't be enough time for anyone to stop them. He pulled the sat phone from his pouch and pressed the preset key that would place a call to Dmitri's identical unit. He held the device to his ear as he waited for it to connect to the satellite in orbit. Once the call went through, Dmitri answered almost instantly.
"Yeah? We will initiate in 5 minutes. Be ready."
"Understood."
Looking back at the iPad, he saw that the target was 2 minutes out. He fiddled nervously with the mine's firing device, shifting it from one hand to the other. He heard the high-pitched whine of a diesel motor climbing the rise, and a shot of panic gripped his chest. Reese didn't drive a diesel. The driver let off the accelerator as the vehicle crested the rise, and a blue flatbed F-250 pickup rolled into view. Whoever was driving had seen Tanya and was rolling to a stop in the kill zone. The driver pulled onto the shoulder opposite her Volkswagen and left the truck idling as he stepped down onto the pavement. A tall, mustached man in his 50s and wearing jeans, boots, and a denim jacket approached Tanya, no doubt offering his assistance. They were too far away for Vitya to hear their conversation. Her body language told the story. She dismissed the man with a wave of her hand, no doubt telling him that help was on the way. The man lingered persistently. Whether it was out of a genuine desire to help or because of Tanya's tank top did not matter to Vitya. He needed this cowboy to get the hell out of the way. His eye moved back to the iPad, where the dot rounded the final bend before it would make its way up to the hill where they waited in ambush. This changed nothing. He would blow the mine and initiate the ambush, no matter what. Reese gripped the wheel with both hands as he steered up the steep grade ahead, driving slower than normal so as not to alarm his passenger. He let up on the gas pedal and let the cruiser coast over the rise, spotting two vehicles pulled off the side of the road ahead of him. From a distance, it looked like a female with car trouble and a man who'd stopped to help. It was nice to be back in a place where people actually cared about their fellow citizens. On cue, his iPhone came alive with the various indicators of the modern age as he entered the service area. Ordinarily, he would sneak a look at his phone to see whether there were any messages from Katie, but with her by his side, there was no reason. She had a real job and was far more accustomed to living in a connected world, and, despite enjoying a well-needed respite from life's distractions, she fished her phone from her purse when she heard it come alive. Reese was taken by surprise when the phone actually began to ring through the vehicle's hands-free Bluetooth system, private number showing up on the LCD screen on the dash. Reese pressed the screen to decline the call, not interested in talking to anyone who wasn't currently riding with him. The phone rang again, and that sixth sense he'd been trying to ignore all morning forced him to answer it. He pressed the green icon to answer the call. "Hello?"
"Reese, it's Vic. Where are you?"
Despite their history, receiving a personal call from the head of the CIA's Special Activities Division wasn't exactly routine. Reese leaned slightly forward in his seat. "I'm in Montana, heading into town. What's happening?"
"No time to explain. There's a Russian mafia plan to hit you and Rafe Hastings. It's happening today."
Reese looked at the cars parked beside the road and considered the sharp curve ahead. He slammed on the brakes, sending Katie forward until her progress was arrested by the seatbelt. The jolt slung her phone out of her hand, and it crashed into the floorboard at her feet.
"Get down!"
Reese yelled, pushing her head down below the dashboard. He put the cruiser in reverse, and the powerful engine revved as the tires spun, finally catching as the SUV lurched to the rear. Smoke billowed from the off-road tires as Reese executed a textbook J-turn, sliding the vehicle from reverse to forward in a fraction of the time it would take to make a three-point turn. The rear window of the cruiser exploded in a shower of tempered glass as a burst of 7.62-millimeter rounds from a member of the support element raked the back of the vehicle. Reese pushed his foot to the floor and took advantage of all 430 horses as he sped away from the kill zone.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, looking at Katie for any sign of injury.
"What?
Are you hit?"
"No, I don't think so. What was that?"
"You just survived your first ambush."
"My first?"
she asked, thinking back to the time that a taxi driver had opened fire on the two of them on a Los Angeles sidewalk.
"Good point. You're second."
"Reese, you okay?"
It was Vic's voice coming through the speakers.
"Yes, sir."
"You with Rafe?"
"No, I'm with Katie."
"Roger that." The phone lost signal as they drove down the hill at almost 100 miles per hour. Katie, I need you to reach behind the seat. There's a rifle mounted to the back of it. Grab it and put it next to me. Katie unbuckled and turned around, returning with the rifle that Rafe had put in the truck for his friend, just in case. Reese knew it was loaded, but took his right hand off the steering wheel to perform a quick press check. He slid it to where he could access it quickly and, without looking, turned the knob on the left side of the scope to illuminate the reticle. He reached for the radio mic hanging on the dash and pressed the talk button. Reese for Rafe, over. Static. Rafe. Rafe, come in, over. Nothing. Reese to Kumba Base, over. Reese to anyone on this channel, this is an emergency, over. No response. Rafe was too far from the main road to hear the gunfire, and they were too far from the ranch to be in radio range. It would take them a few minutes until they were inside the repeater network that allowed the ranch staff to maintain contact while on the property. Reese pushed the cruiser to the maximum speed that its low gear ratio would allow, the knobby tires propelling them back toward Kumba.
Chapter 38. St. Petersburg, Russia.
Gray stared excitedly at the screen of his desktop, watching the signal from the Iridium GPS indicator steer toward the ambush site. It wouldn't be long now. Svetlana had made an excuse not to stay late, which suited him just fine. He couldn't stomach the embarrassment of his recent performance and pushed his sexual attraction for her to the back of his mind. He felt a tinge of jealousy for the men who would send Reese to his grave, men who had no grievance with the SEAL commander. To Gray, it was personal. While to these men, who would get to see the action up close, it was a professional job. The dot made its way to the highway, and Gray shifted nervously. He crossed and uncrossed his legs and wrung his sweaty palms. The dot finally began to climb the hill. He rose to his feet, pushed his chair backward, and leaned forward with his hands on the desk. The dot moved to the top of the terrain feature and began to slow. Then it stopped. He willed the dot forward, first silently and now vocally.
Go! Go! Move forward! Keep going!
The dot began to move backward, first slowly and then more rapidly away from the well-laid ambush.
No! No!
Gray snatched the phone from its cradle on his desk and dialed the number from the post-it note on the side of his monitor. It took forever to connect, and then rang several times before there was an exasperated answer in English with a thick Russian accent.
What?
What happened?
Gray shouted.
I don't know. Some cowboys stopped to help right in the kill zone. Then the target stopped and took off.
Did you fire?
Not until he drove away.
Shit!
What do you want us to do?
Call the other team and tell them to execute. Move to the ranch house. Kill the primary target. Wait, just kill everyone!
He yelled into the receiver.
We don't have a vehicle. The girl drove away and isn't answering her phone.
Shit!
Gray slammed the phone, ending the call. A few valleys away, Rafe knelt at the track in the sand, its crisp outline indicating its extreme freshness. The droppings in front of it were still glistening with moisture. The deer's gait had changed to a relaxed meander as he'd increased the distance between himself and whatever had startled him from his lair. With a flick of his wrist, Rafe shook a cotton infant sock, sending a small white puff of the talcum powder inside into the air. The light breeze blew the powder back and slightly to his left, indicating he still had the wind in his favor. He moved into a prone position and slid his body forward so that he could see into the open valley below him. It was one of the largest meadows on Kumba, a grassy bowl hundreds of yards across that was intersected by small creeks and a few scattered trunks from ancient toppled pines that were bleached nearly white by their exposure to the sun's rays. Slowly, he pulled the strap of his binoculars, bringing them within reach. He painstakingly searched the valley through the 10x lenses, systematically searching each quadrant of ground before moving his focus to the next. 10 minutes into the exercise, he saw it. The flick